If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. You better watch out.
Three.
Arr.
Arr.
It's Space Pirate Radio time once again, Buckos, here on another Wednesday evening, February the 1st, 2017, 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So that would make it universal time of 2 o'clock in the morning, February the 2nd, Thursday morning, again, 2017. So if that happens to be your time, that means you are listening to us live, and of course, that is the best time to be a part of the crew by coming over to the astronomy.fm chat room and logging in, and welcome aboard to everybody that's here right now. We've so far, we've got me and you. We've got Black Project, Evil Spock, Kevin Unique, Plaid Joan, Glenn, Observing Space, Plaid Mac, Twist Edge, Aqua for You, Optronics, a lot of regular crew members, and some new people. I invite everybody to come on over. We'll if we talk about specific articles that we've been reading, we'll put the links into the chat room so you can do further reading. Or you can ask us questions right in the chat room, and we'll try to answer them online, and we'll at least try to say hi to you when you come on in. So welcome aboard, everybody. Another Wednesday evening. Started out, just got to talk about the weather a little bit, started out with the very first sunny day in about 6 weeks.
I was going to say, Marty, there was this big, bright thing in the sky today, and I, you know, it was interesting. Do you know what it was? Yeah,
It was a star.
It was a star, which we
way too close.
Yeah, very bright. Actually, it was, I was kind of uncomfortable driving.
Yeah, I kind of knew I was going to be too. It was not a cloud in the sky, completely blue, because all the junk that's been, you know, all the snow has been, you know, bringing all the particles down to the ground. And it lasted till late this afternoon, and then we got a blizzard. So clear skies to blizzard. Isn't that fun? But, you know, did get a chance to see a little bit of the sun. Speaking of the sun, okay, I got some sunspots. They're starting to go away. Two main groups, active region 2632 in the north and active region 2629. There's about a half a dozen spots there, all of them smaller than the Earth, but it's the only spots on the sun right now. So if you want to get a view of the sun, you'll see a little bit, but not much. However, there has been some coronal holes on the sun, which has been spewing out solar wind particles. We were expected to hit a bit of a hot spot, and we're hitting it right now. Wind speeds are way up at 670 kilometers per second. A particle density, that's a little bit thin. It's 2.68 protons per cubic centimeter. So not a whole lot of particles, but what's there is pretty active and hitting us pretty hard. So definitely if you live in the around the polar region, north polar region, I should say, the Arctic, you got a really good chance of getting some aurora, and there has been pretty good aurora reports lately. So another few more days of this should continue on. And there's a bit, kind of a fairly large coronal hole in the southern half of the sun right now. So that's going to keep spewing out some stuff for at least a few more days. Then we'll see what happens after that.
Yeah. So we mentioned, or rather Marty said it's been 6 weeks since we saw the sun. He's really not joking by much.
Yes.
Out of the 31 days in January, Michigan, where we live, had two sunny days. Two.
I think I missed them both.
Take that, Seattle. Seriously. Now, last night, I did happen to be out. I made a late night mail run to the local post office. And as I came back, the winter hexagon was shining overhead. It was the first time I had seen all of the stars. The great Capella. Castor, Pollux, Procyon, Sirius, Rigel, Aldebaran, then Betelgeuse in the middle. First time I'd seen them all since calendar year.
Let's call it the December hexagon.
Good point.
Because it is well visible around equatorial regions and a little bit south of that too. So that's the summer season. So we can't say it's a winter grouping of stars when it's well visible from some southern latitudes too. Just compared to us, upside down.
Which would be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. Missed a nice thin crescent moon by some planets too.
Yeah,
some reports of Venus and Mars. Not Venus. Was it Mars and Venus? Maybe it was.
It was Mars, Venus, and the Moon. I saw some very nice pictures on Facebook. Actually, I think our buddy Stephen Ramsden was posting some of those pictures.
Okay.
Yeah. From this Charlie Bates Solar Observatory.
Ah, very good. Our buddy Stephen Ramsden, we've got to get him back on the air real soon, too.
Yeah.
Been a while. Still plugging along with his organization.
Outreach.
Yes, Free Solar Outreaches. And they have branches around the world. One of them is Australia. One of them is in Kosovo. I always like to mention them whenever we can. Yes, they do take telescopes out and do free solar observing. They don't charge for that. So that's the way to do it. Of course, we got a big solar event coming up in the third week of August. I still have to get my – I only mention this because it keeps reminding me to buy a solar filter.
You'd better buy a solar filter.
I think I better buy a solar filter.
I think you'd better buy one now, Marty.
I think so, too.
Don't wait till August.
I know. Definitely. That's why I keep reminding myself by mentioning it on air that, yeah, got this nice eclipse going all the way across the United States, coast to coast. So there's probably a chance of me seeing this one. But you never know. Well, at least there should be some clear spot. I just have to find it and get there in time. So it's going to be some grueling driving, but I'll get there. Hopefully I can pick it off from around the closest to me. But that does leave a pretty good arc everywhere from like Iowa to Kentucky approximately, or even a little farther east than that too. Carolinas maybe, something like that. So I got a chance for this one. Hope you're planning to view it. Hope some of you are traveling from other countries to come over here and see it. It should be quite a nice one. I can't remember. Oh, I've got to look this up, what an eclipse looks like during solar minimum times. I can't remember if the corona, that's the outer atmosphere of the sun, which that's what shows up during the during totality, that kind of a bright fuzzy bunch of
halo, yeah,
nice halo. That's a good word for it. Big halo around the sun. It'll have two different shapes. Sometimes it's rounder, more fuller, and sometimes it's more pulled in towards the north and south poles of the sun. And one of them's for solar minimum, one of them's solar maximum. So I can't remember which one is which. If we have a chance of seeing a more interesting shape to it or a fuller one, because we might need to make up for some lack of prominences, but we'll see what happens. Still got plenty of time to plan. Already seeing some questionable practices and people taking advantage of them. One was actually a church. They're going to have a special spiritual event and only charge $300 or $400 to be there at the same time. Well, thank you very much. No, you don't.
Yeah.
Let me give you a clue. A lot of the hotels, motels right along the path line are, yes, they're charging 3-4 times their normal rates.
And making you lock in yourself for many more days than is normal.
Right. But it's not that hard to get regular prices 100 miles away, 50 miles away. What's that? Oh, let's say 70 miles. That's an hour's drive. So it's not hard to drive an hour on the freeway and get a room at the regular rates. Yeah, regular rates are about like $80, $90, something like that for side of the road, side of the freeway type of motel.
Well, I think one thing to watch out for, too, is just sort of garden variety scams. People, I have heard of reports that I hope are apocryphal of people along the path planning to fence off their yards and offer it as premium real estate for solar eclipse. It's going to be good anywhere along the path. This is not something where you need, say, a perfect horizon line. Or I mean, it's a solar eclipse. The moon's going in front of the sun. Anywhere along the path that is not in the middle of the highway where you might get hit by a car.
Right.
It's going to be premium space.
I think the path width, isn't it? They're usually like 50, 60 miles, something like that.
Yeah, this cuts through entire cities.
Well, yeah. Let's say, I have to look it up. I think it's like 50 miles wide and 3,000 miles long. So you got a pretty good chance of being pretty much anywhere. It could be one of those pull off to the side of the roads and watch the eclipse.
Which I think is what you're doing, right?
That's pretty much what I'm going to do, yes. Because one thing I'm not going to be doing, a lot of people want to get locked into a place, so they've got their hotel, motel reservations in one spot. Okay, they picked a nice area, maybe like the Badlands out west where there's a lot of really nice mountainous scenery and valleys and stuff like that, or in the Smoky Mountains, which is the central part of the country. They're more like hills, but they're really nice and green. So some really, really nice places for some really good scenery, but it might be cloudy there and you might have to move. So you might get some nice scenery if you stay there and not see the eclipse. I'm going to be traveling. I'm going to get ready to travel. I'm going to figure out where the clear spot's going to be. I'm going to head there. The plain states like Iowa, Nebraska, stuff like that, it's all pretty much flat farmland.
Yeah.
And in like Nebraska, it's so dry. Most of the grasslands have all basically browned out and it's flat. There's nothing green. Flat for, 500 miles. It's pretty easy to go anywhere, even pull off on a country road and be able to see it.
And with something like this, for instance, my husband and I saw the transit of Venus in 2012. We pulled off an interstate freeway in California in a rest area and set up shop there. And people were happy.
Uh-huh.
Truckers taking a break. Families with kids taking a break. Everybody wanted to have a look. So that can actually be a very fun way of doing it.
Yes. Just don't forget to give yourself back the telescope when it comes to the total eclipse time, because you want to see the best view then. So if you have some take some solar glasses. They're pretty easy to get, pretty cheap to get. Your astronomy club might be actually selling them for a little bit of profit, but they'll only be a couple of dollars. So get some of those solar glasses and keep extra ones. I would carry like a dozen extra. They work really good as bribes to people. It's like, can I park in your driveway here? Here, you want to see the eclipse? Here's some solar glasses. You can keep them. And you spent, a buck and a half or $3 doing that. So it works actually pretty nice doing that. And then you can give people a view through your telescope. We'll talk more about getting your equipment ready for public viewing especially. But we'll get into that some other time as it comes on. But do a little bit of planning. There's going to be some prime spots like anywhere along the eastern coast on the eclipse. That's a very, very prime touristy area. So everything's going to be congested and expensive. For the middle of the country, plain states, probably one of the best places to actually see it. Get off to the west. Again, you get into some wild country. It's actually pretty nice, but it's pretty sparse, so that'll be, again, touristy and expensive. Plenty of places to see it, though. So make sure you get all your – if you're coming from another country, get all your passports and stuff that you need. Get all your paperwork done ahead of time.
Yeah, and be prepared for a fluid changing situation on that front, and that's all I got to say about that.
Yep. That's all. I'm going to rent a car, not even take my own car. I'm going to rent a car, which is actually pretty cheap, and be ready to drive around.
Okay, but that's still in August. And
yes.
So the reason we will keep bringing it up is because since it's going to be such a big event, your chances of improvising get smaller and smaller if you forgot to do things like order your solar filter.
Exactly. So that's why I will keep reminding you. Just keep reminding me.
Yes. So, what's going on in the world right now other than we finally saw the sun?
Let's see. Let me give you an update on planets and stuff like that. Let's see. Today is Wednesday the 1st, so we have Mars will be 2 degrees north of the moon. On Thursday tomorrow for me, that would be Uranus will be 3 degrees north of the moon. Friday, Ceres, 1 degree south of the moon, and somewhere in the world, going to be an occultation. And let me see, on February the 3rd, 2 hours, I bet we're going to be able to, depends if we're north or south or not, so 1 degree. I don't know if we'll be north or south or not, but well, at least the timing will be right because it's 2 hours universal time. So it'll be like now, 9 o'clock on Friday. I'll have to look and see if we'll be far enough north or south for it to actually occur. So somewhere around eastern portion of North America, we'll have the moon go in front of Sirius. Saturday, first quarter moon. Sunday, Aldebaran, 0.2 degrees south of the moon. And again, somewhere there's going to be an occultation. Let's see, that's going to be 22 hours. So that's our local time of 5 o'clock. Will the moon be out then? Yeah, it might actually be a daytime event for us. Again, north to south is going to make a bit of a difference whether we'll be able to see it or not, though. So there's some planets and moon occultations coming up.
Yeah, Venus did look dazzling tonight. I saw it through some holes in the clouds as I was driving around.
Did you?
Yeah.
I didn't see it. Like I said, I was having a blizzard when I looked out this evening.
You're a bit to the north of me.
A little bit, yeah. Let me check some AAVSO notices. Let's see. We've got one here, an alert notice number 566. Beta pick observations required for BRITE, that's B-R-I-T-E, constellation, which the BRITE stands for Bright Target Explorer Constellation. The satellite suite is obtaining high-precision photometry of selected very bright, like greater than fourth magnitude stars. I'll just read the top paragraph here. Its purpose is to investigate the stellar structure and evolution of the brightest stars in the sky and their interaction with the local environment. I would take it that would mean their local environment, not our local environment. All right, so obviously some quite easy stars to do some observing with. And they want to do multicolor photometry, blue, violet, red. Usually that means you can probably do it with your CCD camera or DSLR camera. Help to have some filters that would be within their standards. Let's see, photometry better than, it's tight tolerances though, 0.01 magnitude. Basically, it can be real short exposures though, so that's not so bad. But I guess you can get those tolerances if you're using a DSLR, for instance, because basically you're comparing center pixel of the target star with some stars off to the side. So basically your imaging processing software will be able to basically measure the intensity of the light in the pixels and give you some fairly accurate measurements that way. Read up on yourself. But so this is one of the easiest experiments for bright stars. Check that out.
Cool.
All right.
Let's see, we got some other things going on in the world.
What do we got in the world?
Well, I've got a little Earth science story, and we do like to point out that just as the sun is a star, the Earth is a planet.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, guess what, Marty?
What?
They found a lost ancient continent.
Really?
Technically. Okay, so.
Atlantis?
No, not Atlantis.
Does it have a pyramid on it?
No pyramids. It's got jewels.
What good is it? It's got what?
Jewels.
Jewels?
Well, okay. So, down in, there was an old continent named Mauritia. And this broke away and formed Madagascar and India about 60 million years ago. And they've found traces of it. Hmm. Old continental crust lying beneath ocean volcanoes.
Hmm. So. This is in the Indian Ocean, no doubt.
So it's a cool little story. I was always interested in lost continents, especially when I was a teenager. You know, Lemuria, Atlantis, things like that. Well, this is a technically lost continent. It's not around anymore, and it has got nothing to do with aliens or lizards or anything else like that. Just a little bit of good geology, and may tell us some more things that we didn't know about plate tectonics.
So it's not like a couple thousand year old continent. We're talking like hundreds of millions of years old continent.
Yeah.
When it was more of a major continent than it is now.
Yeah, like I said, its heyday seems to have been about 60 million years ago.
Oh, 50 million?
60.
60. Okay, that's when it was
Mauritia.
Okay. continents come, continents go. There's a, well, I don't know. They're talking whole continents. I'd have to find the definition of a continent, I guess, technically. Because there's got to be little chunks of continents all over the place.
Yeah, that's a good one. Because in its current state, it's called a microcontinent. So then that sort of gets like dwarf planets. Okay, we got continents and microcontinents and
Yeah, then and where's the definition? Where's the dividing point between a continent and not a continent? How much stuff? And
I think we need a geologist for that one.
Yeah, I bet every geologist we got, we would get a different answer also.
The definition of a planet involves a lot of shenanigans. Uh-huh. I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that the geologists are a more rational bunch.
Mm. Are you kidding? These guys have rocks in their heads.
Ooh.
Astronomers
We share room space with the Michigan Mineralogical Society, remember? They might throw things at you next time.
As I say, astronomers have a lot of space in their heads, so it's one or the other.
Space or rocks.
That's right.
I'm not even going to ask what you think, how your poor opinion of biologists.
How about oceanographers?
How about them?
Yeah, water on the brain.
All right. I should have saved this story for the end of the night.
Maybe. Got to find another pyramid story. That's all there is to it. Oh, so regular observing. We've still got lots of planets out there and some minor planets too. So just take a little bit more of an effort to get out and do some regular observing series. Like I already mentioned, Scribner Occultation series. Still have the Dawn mission at series. Still sending back more information. Better pictures, everything's going along. We're still actually having scientists analyze Pluto.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have continuing missions at Jupiter and Saturn.
The ongoing death dive of Cassini.
That's right.
Nice pictures. You enjoyed any of the latest pictures coming through from there?
Just a little bit. Haven't had that much time to really get caught up on them. I've been working installing a brand new exhibit at our museum all about King Tutankhamun. And that's going to open in another couple of days. So I'm
I have an invitation for the opening night tomorrow that I unfortunately won't be able to make. So I regret that.
What's tomorrow? Tomorrow's Thursday, right?
Yeah. Well, I've got some nice photo gallery. Let's go with the one from got a few different sites that we'll share with you. Remember that the links that we share with our crew in the chat room during the live broadcast do get posted on our Facebook page.
Which is called Space Pirate Radio, astronomy.fm.
Yep. So
like our Facebook page. Those numbers up there.
If you catch us on a repeat, can always follow along.
We'll put the links in there that we were talking about. And I always try to make announcements on our Facebook page before the show. So in case we have some technical difficulties where we cannot have a show, you'll know on our Facebook page. So that's where I'll post that announcement, let you know ahead of time. So check it out, and we'll keep you up to date like that. Some general news articles, of course. We'll get to some of those. I think of what's just some general astronomy stuff. We haven't really had many questions in our chat room sometime about astronomy stuff. I think we need more questions out there. We used to do a thing in our astronomy club. It was called Ask a Stupid Question. It was for basically beginners that were afraid to ask a question because they thought it was too stupid and people would make fun of them. It's like, nope. That's what we're here for, and it actually became a regular feature for quite a few years. So, yeah, the only stupid question you can ask in astronomy is the one that you don't ask. Let's see. What was your favorite comet sighting? Oh, there's one. Well, this is not fact, obviously, so it's just my opinion. Well, favorite comet sighting? Oh, there's been several good ones. Comet West was one of the good ones, and then Hayakitake and Hale-Bopp. So those are about my three top ones because those were classic comets, easily visible. Comet West was early in the morning before sunrise, and it was a little bit chilly, so that was a little bit tough. Hale Bopp and Hayakitake were evening comets, so those were kind of nice. But I've kind of like some of the unique ones, like Comet Holmes.
I love Comet Holmes.
Which did not look like a classic comet, which is, no. You know, a couple of tails streaking, splaying off to one side. It was a giant fuzz ball.
Poof.
Yes.
Big puff ball.
It kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I think it looked about the size of the full moon, except that it was about 1 million miles in diameter. So that was a unique one. Did not show tail from our perspective because I think it was traveling away from us when it did that. There has been some other ones close by like that. Comet Iras, Raki Elcock was another one like that. Close one, but it was just basically a ball. Very close. It would actually move maybe like a degree or so every hour. So that was a really fast one. But it did not move. It did not move like a comet they show in movies or a cartoon where it basically moves at the speed of somebody throwing a baseball up in the air. A lot of the movies will show that. You know, like try to imagine taking a ball with a bunch of strings on it and throwing it across your yard. And that's what a lot of people think a comet travels that fast. No, a comet generally will sit in one spot for several days before you can even notice a little bit of movement.
There was at least one fairly fast one I remember within the last decade. It was not a public eye-catching wow sort of comet. But mm-hmm. I think that we were able to detect motion over the course of the night.
Mm-hmm. Aquafew mentioned, our chat room mentioned comet Swassman-Walkman when it broke up into six comets.
When was that? I missed that one.
You know, it sounds familiar, but I can't remember. I must have seen that because it sounds so familiar. Of course, then Shoemaker Levy 9, which I don't think I actually saw it as comets. All I saw were the impacts. That's the one that flew by Jupiter, broke up into nine pieces plus a few more after a little bit, and then they circled around and smacked right into the planet Jupiter back in 1994, something like that, 91, 94, can't remember exactly. But I don't remember actually seeing the comet particles themselves. I mostly remember seeing the impact regions on Jupiter itself. There have been lots of comets I've seen. I've probably seen at least two or three dozen of them. I used to keep track of them. I don't anymore. I just look and then try to take some pictures. And maybe I catch some, maybe I don't. I saw Halley's Comet. It was okay because it was only the historical aspect of it that made it interesting. As far as being a comet goes, it was just okay.
I have had three comets that I genuinely got top-rate enjoyment out of in my life. Okay. Keep in mind, I started observing as a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember Halley's Comet. I remember nothing. Wasn't good. Hayakitake and Hale Bopp back-to-back in the late 90s and then Comet Holmes. That's mm-hmm. basically it. I missed all the other good ones. I wasn't around for West. I wasn't around for Bennett. I wasn't around for... I wasn't really doing astronomy for a while, so there might have been a few things I missed in the late 90s post Hale Bopp. Yeah, basically Hale Bopp, Hayakitake, and Holmes.
Mm-hmm. There was some that I missed also just as I started getting into astronomy mid 70s. I think there was a Comet Bennett that came around before Comet West that was supposed to have been kind of good, but I missed that. Now, some comets will have the same name because it's the discoverer that gets the comet named after them. And there's been more of a tradition lately if there's been multiple discoveries and, you know, like unannounced, but several people see it like on the same night, they will give credit to up to three people now, I think, and that's it. So we'll talk about like a Comet Bennett. Well, there's might have been 24 Comet Bennett's in the past 50 years or so, because he was quite a prolific comet finder. So he had, there was a lot of Comet Bennett's, so you have to kind of designate when that comet was. And there was other ones too, some of the satellites that have discovered some comets. They get named after the name of the satellite. So there will be, if you just go look at what's the, one of the websites I use for comet, like Weekly Comets, Chasing Comets, one of the, either of those two websites, you scroll down the list and you'll see several of them that have a similar name to them. And if you see the letter P next to the designation, usually you'll see a date, like if it was discovered in 2016, the name of the comet will be 2016 with a slash, let's say 17P. That means it was the 17th comet discovered in 2016. P means it's periodic, that it will come back again in a kind of a regular orbit. Some of the orbits or comets are quite regular. There's, I think it's Comet Encke that goes, appears about every three years, three and a third years.
Very short period comet.
Yeah.
Which is why nobody gets excited about Comet Encke, because it always comes back and it comes around so often. It's never going to do some fantastic thing.
Several of them. Giacobini-Zinner comes around regularly. Comet Swift-Tuttle. Swassmann-Walkman. There's ones, periodic ones of that. Halley's Comet, of course. Regular visitors. But some of them do not. Some of them are in a what's called a hyperbolic orbit. Comes in from way out, goes around the sun, and heads on out, never to repeat the same orbit again. Before we go any farther, let's do a little station identification. Going fast tonight. You are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is another Friday, sorry, another Wednesday evening, February the 1st. This one happens to be 2017. We're about 3 minutes past 9:30 in the evening for us here in the eastern portion of North America. So that would mean make it universal time at 2:33 on Thursday morning, February the 2nd, 2017. So halfway through our program. If you missed the first half, don't forget we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So you can catch us on the repeat if you want to. Let's see. Coming up after Space Pirate Radio, well, where's that message that I just had about what's coming up here? We don't have Astronomy Ireland. They're still not broadcasting lately. So let's see. We will have Naked Astronomy Special on Radio Astronomy in Australia. Also, Planetary Radio, titled The Final Countdown at Saturn. Planetary
Radio.
Final
Radio's Countdown. Ooh.
The Final Countdown. We'll have to talk about that. With project scientist Linda Spilker. We've got Naked Scientists, Humanity's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and Naked Astronomy on the Milky Way's Local Black Hole.
Sounds like a real good lineup.
Yeah, so you can keep listening in after Space Pirate Radio and catch all that. Or when it's more convenient, you'll be able to catch it throughout the next 24 hours. All right, where were we? Comets, different types of comets, stuff like that. So there are a few comets. Somebody was it our radio director that was saying he was looking at one of the comets?
Ooh.
Was it? Was that Rob this earlier?
I missed that.
I think that was him.
Showed up in the chat room a little after you. That's cool. Well, we're hoping again that this will be the year that some of the comets that are out there will do something good.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do something good, you'll definitely hear from us. But until it happens, I'm hedging my bets.
Yeah. Some of the comets are one of those that are technically bright, like 6 magnitude. That sounds really great. But when it's in a 4th magnitude sky.
Yeah.
Like in twilight. Doesn't work so well. Let's see. 45P, Honda, Merkos, Pedjuksakova. That's one of the main ones out right now. Let's see. This is from, where are we at here? Weekly Bright Comets. Bright very rapidly as predicted. Now 6.3 magnitude. That was a little while ago. Several weeks ago. Now it's about 7 magnitude. So it approached down to about 0.08 astronomical units from the Earth. One astronomical unit, by the way, is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So 100 million miles. So at a tenth of that would put it about 10 million miles, 8 million miles, something like that. That would be in mid-February. So that means it'll be kind of close to us, but it also means it might be kind of near twilight too. So not so great. We got Comet C, 2016 U1, NEOWISE. That's about eighth, ninth magnitude now, something like that. Not that great one. And then everything else that basically they've got them in brightness order. Down from there is like 10th magnitude for Comet Johnson-Encke. Did I mention Comet Encke earlier?
You did.
It's like that's starting to come around. Right now it's about 10th, 11th magnitude. So technically in the sky, but it could be a bit of a challenge to see it. It's supposed to brighten up to 8.5 magnitudes. Maybe in March or something, might get up to about 8 magnitudes. So it's okay. I want to work on a better way of judging magnitudes, though, for comets for our listeners. I don't really like the way most of these sites do comet magnitudes.
Because comets are diffuse. They are not singular points of light.
Right.
So it's misleading. It's like when people talk about certain galaxies, go, oh, well, the integrated magnitude of the galaxy, that is like, yeah, and it's spread over the an area the size of the moon.
That's right. So, yeah, one of the ways of doing that was to basically take a star. Let's say they call it an eighth magnitude comet. Well, you take an eighth magnitude star, defocus it until it's the exact same size as the comet, and they call that eighth magnitude. No, usually when you defocus an eighth magnitude star, it looks like 11th magnitude object. You can't see it anymore when you rack it out that big. Some of it's deceiving because the very center could be bright. The outer edges will be dim. I'm going to work on a different way of doing it, maybe more based on aperture, where you can barely see it in what size telescope. This is kind of a plan I've had before. Maybe I'll have to do it with some galaxies and things like that. So if you could see it with a 2-inch telescope, a galaxy that's kind of spread out, but you could see it, okay, that counts as one thing. Now if it's going to take a 6-inch telescope and you can barely see it, what magnitude would that be? And then like an 8 and 10 and 20-inch and stuff like that. So I'm going to work on a different kind of scale that might be a little bit more practical for people to figure out if they can actually see some. There's been a lot of 10th magnitude comets that I could not see with my 8-inch telescope. Same thing with some galaxies, too. They called it, 10th magnitude galaxy, and it was just not there.
Yeah, 10th magnitude, that's one of the most misleading things out there. That's as bad as comets.
Yeah. Galaxies are kind of the same, where they have the bright core and got fainter area all around it.
But there's a huge difference between when you're dealing with an edge-on galaxy where it's this integrated magnitude is coming from a nice little line,
mm-hmm.
and a face-on spiral galaxy.
Yes.
Like, Marty, what is the integrated magnitude of M33?
Oh, I don't know.
Triangulum galaxy in our autumn skies.
What is it, about as bright as the full moon or something like that?
I'm actually going to look it up because M33 is a bright galaxy. It is very close to us.
Sort of.
It is also huge.
Yes.
Absolutely huge. And consequently, okay, so it's got an apparent magnitude of 5.72. So,
that's
between fifth and sixth magnitude.
Technically, that's, a little bit off. I have seen it. I would make it a magnitude dimmer. I'd put it about 6 magnitude. I have seen it in super dark skies,
yes.
Really great conditions, averted vision with just my eyes, right on the edge of visibility. So if technically naked eye or you know, barely visible as 6 magnitude. Mm-hmm. I'd say it was hovering pretty close to that. But it doesn't take much to brighten it up. You know, pair of binoculars will pick it out fairly well.
Oh, yeah,
well.
Totally. Pair of binoculars. So we actually tried last year with because it has visible – it has detectable nebulae in its arms. I tried mm-hmm. to see if I could pick it out naked eye using an oxygen 3 filter
mm-hmm.
from the Arizona mountains. This did not work, but I will try again.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine taking a 6 magnitude star and making it as big as M33 and still be able to actually see it. I think it would have to disappear. But now I can imagine using a 2-inch telescope to see M33. That certainly would happen. But I can't imagine, like, with any telescope, taking a 6 magnitude star and just defocusing it till it's a big fuzzball and still be able to see it. And I don't see that happening. So I have to come up with a new scale. I'm going to see if I can work on a more practical scale for, you know, to give everybody an idea if they can actually see something. So, for instance, like, can you see it in a pair of binoculars? Can you see it in a 4-inch? Can you see it a 6, 8, and 10? Stuff like that. So I'll give you some – I'll have to do some galaxy practicing because obviously those objects will be there – a long time compared to some of the comets that are out there. So if I get an idea what how bright a galaxy would be, then when the comets come out, maybe I can we can kind of correlate how big a comet would be compared to a comparative galaxy and what type of telescope you'd actually need to see it in. So a lot of it's just sky conditions too. You know, it could be fairly bright but diffuse, and if your sky is really bright, you're not going to see it. So one of the problems with the Messier Marathon that comes up in March, the objects that you have to see early in the morning and then very late in the evening, you have to see in twilight, and they're fairly faint objects. So it's no problem seeing those objects. It's just when there's twilight there, you're just not going to pick them up. Some people have done them, but I think they've kind of been, you know, like high in the mountains, a little bit thinner air, gets a little bit darker. Doesn't brighten up quite so fast. I think that was allowed them to see. Because I remember one of the objects was M74.
That it's a face, one's tricky.
Face-on galaxy. Is it an Aquarius or something like that? Or
Pisces, yeah.
Something like that. And
hard
that
to
was,
see from Michigan at that time of the year.
Yeah.
Or that impossible? Is that one the one that's technically impossible?
Yeah, I think technically impossible from pretty much any normal place. But like I said, I think it's been seen up in a mountain
cool.
during the Messier Marathon.
If I do a Messier Marathon, I'm taking a road trip or maybe a plane trip.
All right. I'm going to read back on the chat room now, Kevin, since I did read what you said, but I didn't read what was said before. Kevin wrote, and Marty is not reading the chat room because he had to laugh at that one.
Not sure if it's the part about aisle 51 at IKEA populated by aliens or the wormhole to Walmart. I don't want to find out about either one of these being true.
So every time I go near a Walmart, my money disappears. Hmm. All right. I'll try to read what I was supposed to laugh at. Let's see.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about sad things. So
sad,
we have
sad or bad? Did you say
sad? Okay. Sad. So last week we talked about the 50th anniversary of Apollo 1, in which the 3 astronauts died in a fire on the launch pad while they were conducting a pre-flight test. We are, of course, all of NASA's human disasters. They have had astronauts in training die in plane crashes over the years because, of course, these people trained in fighter jets and sometimes things went very wrong, but the entire crew being wiped out happened with Apollo 1, Challenger, and Columbia. And so if you happen to scan the space news today, there were a lot of memorials to the crew of Columbia, STS-107, which was the death knell of the entire space shuttle program. The loss of the second shuttle basically demonstrated that it was not a craft that could be trusted in the long term, not to kill people because of the design, because of the reusability, because of the tiles. And so I've got one interesting tribute here, and I encourage you all to check it out and reflect upon it, because for all that it's been very frustrating that NASA has had no means of getting its own astronauts up into space, there is a reason for that. I see in the space Aquifer, you say NASA TV has been endlessly showing the disaster. Well, that's a good reason not to tune into NASA TV today. I don't ever want to see that again. That was a horrible day.
Let's see. All right, let's see. So we almost got hit by an asteroid today,
or maybe
it's tomorrow.
We could all die tomorrow. Okay, guess I'll have another drink tonight.
It's one of those good news, bad news types of things.
So how big is this asteroid? It can't be that big because I haven't seen Mass Panic.
That's correct. It's only about 60 feet in diameter.
Okay.
And it's going to fly by tomorrow. I don't see what time, but it's going to fly by about 100,000 miles away from us.
Okay, so not anywhere near as far as the moon.
That's correct.
So about
half the distance between us and the moon.
Yeah, so if it hit, what would it take out?
60 feet. I think that would be kind of like a Chelyabinsk event.
Okay.
So,
window rattler.
So definitely a window breaker. Yeah. Would, be some stray rocks and stuff like that. So, minimal amount of deaths. I'd say more like injuries, broken glass types of injuries, stuff like that. Rocks hitting somebody, might be a few people that got hit by a couple chunks, something like that. Nothing really, really major. But 100,000 miles is more than far enough. This one's designated 2017 BS-32. You can find it on spaceweather.com down near the bottom there, the Near Earth Asteroids. And also let me put a link into our chat room. This one happens to be from Astronomy Magazine on this one. Let me pop it in down there. You can read the further details on it. You still got another day to check it out. Let's see. Now, the question is, now it says it's going to, let's see, a newly discovered asteroid is zipping between Earth and the moon tomorrow. Well, yes.
That sounds exciting.
Yes and no sometimes. Now, passing directly between the Earth and the moon would be really cool.
Yeah.
Because if you're in just the right spot,
you'll see a transit.
You will see, yes, go across the face of the moon. Now, that would be actually pretty cool.
That'd be great.
It's actually really, really rare. Now, sometimes it might pass at that distance. Like I said, it's going to be about 100,000 miles away from us. Now, between the Earth and the moon, that's cool. But it might actually pass north of the moon, might pass south of the moon, might pass over our North Pole. I don't know if I've got any data. You can look it up. It's like in several places. So look it up and find out where it's actually going to be. If it is going to pass in front of the moon, probably want to check out a website called CalSky, CalSky. They always have predictions of when a artificial satellite is going to pass in front of the moon or the sun or even a planet, and it calculates it for your observing location. So you can look on that website and see if this object happens to be listed there. And if maybe if you're lucky, you'll actually be able to get it to go in front of the moon or something like that. Assuming it's passing at nighttime, it might actually pass in front of the sun.
Ooh.
That'd be pretty cool,
too. That'd be nice, too.
Yeah. But let's see, 60 feet across, 100,000 miles. That would be really a tough one. Because what's the space station? A couple hundred feet across?
A couple football fields, I think, yeah.
Yeah, when it passes in front of the sun or the moon, it's actually really small.
Yeah, it's much closer and it would be significantly larger. So, yes,
that would be tricky. That's like 200 miles away and twice as big as this rock. So, if it's 100,000 miles away and half the size of a rock, or the rock's half the size of the space station, might not actually be able to see it. So you're probably better off if you can just get the light from it if it passes by at nighttime in just the right spot. If it goes into the shadow of the Earth, again, we're going to have, you know, that issue. So I have to do a little bit of extra research and find out if it's actually going to be visible.
Speaking of research, so scientists at the University of Michigan, yay, have released research that suggests that spaceflight messes with your brain. So they've studied 26 astronauts who spent time in space between 2008 to 2012. They did structural MRIs of all these astronauts before and after spaceflight, and they found that every single one of them had changes to the gray matter of the brain. Hmm. Increases here, decreases there. Got an interesting article from Gizmodo.com that has lots of pictures for you to absorb. So, given that the long-term effects of spaceflight on the human body are a problem that we are going to be having to deal with if we're going to Mars or anywhere else, might want to spend some time reading it and processing it.
All right. Special request from the chat room. Here goes. I'm being followed by a moon shadow. Moon shadowing shadow. Arr!
Don't quit the day job, Marty.
Yeah. So they said, Platt Jones says, as long as Marty doesn't start singing moon shadow. So you think I'm not reading the chat room, hey? Once in a while I am.
Oh, boy.
Plaid Max says, thanks a lot, Joan.
And speaking of long-term changes in space, we got some initial data back on the great NASA twins study.
Yes, indeed.
So to recap, the twin astronauts, now both retired, Mark Kelly stayed on Earth. Scott Kelly went up into space for an entire year living on the ISS. And they have got studied down to their genes and their telomeres, specifically the telomeres. So telomeres, part of your chromosomes. All right, so we're talking chromosomes in the cells.
Okay.
You might remember the diagrams of cells dividing when in the biology textbooks, the chromosomes, and they separate, and then you end up with two identical cells. And then over time, as you're aging and your cells are replicating, the telomeres decrease in length. This is a established fact. They decrease in length as you age. So one of the concerns about clones back when Dolly the sheep first arrived on the scene was that since she was cloned from a mature sheep, she would have old telomeres from birth. And Dolly did have premature arthritis and things like that in a fairly short lifespan for a sheep. I don't believe that was seen in later cloned livestock, but it was a concern. Okay, so what does space do to your telomeres? Well, Scott's increased, only in space. The guy's up in the space station. Yes, he's exercising every day. He's got a reduced caloric intake compared with what one assumes his normal diet on Earth is. And the telomeres are increasing rather than decreasing. He goes back to Earth. And Michael in our mission control is saying, well, what superpowers does he get? Well, the superpowers got taken away by Earth, so he's only superhuman in space. I don't think he's Superman. Mm-hmm. What are the implications? It's going to be a while before we get all of the data and all of the implications. But I was not expecting that particular one.
So in that way, space is good for you?
If you wanted to take it the most inappropriate, tabloid, heady, like when you're cherry-picking things off certain UK publications, you could say that space prevents aging. But we're not going to say that, because that's not what it actually means.
Like wine is healthy for you.
Cheers.
That type of thing. Cheers. Clink. So if you want to duplicate yourself, you have to improve your clone-mosomes.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. No puns. Wait, there's a pun advocate in the chat room. Let's kick him out. Just kidding, Kevin. We don't have those powers. Yeah. So then besides the cellular data, there's some preliminary things have already been released about, you know, biochemical profile, their microbiomes, the way that Mark and Scott were affected by a flu vaccine, things like that. So fascinating stuff, and look forward to a lot more as they analyze the Great Twin Study.
Here's a little article. I just hit an astronomy magazine tonight, I guess. This one is about, if I hit the right article, glass plates.
Ooh, Harvard's collection, yes.
How Harvard's vast collection of glass plates still shapes astronomy. Now, explain to you what glass plates are. These are photographic plates. Now, some of you might be too young to remember old-style photography, but this is really, really old-style photography. So now what we have, obviously, cameras is a digital sensor, CCDs, charge-coupled devices. So each tiny little dot is electrophotosensitive. So when a photon hits that little dot, it sends an electrical signal through the system and gives it a value. So that's how cameras work today. Before that was film. Usually black and white film was a silver material in kind of a gel, and it was laid onto plastic, real flexible. And then when light hit the silver, it chemically reacted to it. Then you had to add more chemicals to it to stop it from reacting and to get the silver, bright silver particles to stick around and be at a certain level, and the dark silver particles might go away or be at a different level, stuff like this. So that's the way the old style photography worked, chemical reaction and silver.
And they still have the plates, and they're really cool, and they're still being used for science 100 years later, right?
Yes, but astronomers didn't like the plastic stuff. They wanted really accurate stuff, so they used that silver chemical solution on sheets of glass. And they would put those sheets of glass into a camera and pop the lens off and expose the sheets of glass with the photochemicals on it. And that's how they got their images on glass plates. I actually took my own glass plate picture one time visiting a friend out in Arizona. And he let me take a glass plate picture.
Hold that thought in time forever, Marty, because I think we got to go for the night.
I think we do. Gone through another version of Space Pirate Radio.
Arr!
So I want to thank everybody in our chat room for tonight being part of our crew. Really appreciate you being here. Glad you were here. Don't forget, we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours, the next 24 hours, with all of our upcoming programs. So keep sticking around. Appreciate you all listening in. And we'll see you again next Wednesday for Space Pirate Radio. Good night, all. Thanks again.
Good night.